Extreme.
The discourse within Zionist Israel regarding the war in Lebanon is increasingly marked by criticism fueled by a belief among many that the Israeli occupation army has made notable gains by targeting Hezbollah's leadership and dismantling its border infrastructure. As a result, pressure is mounting on the government to seek a political settlement. The debate over a political settlement is becoming inseparable from the realities on the battlefield as fears mount over Hezbollah's resilience and its capacity to strike back, eroding Zionist Israel's gains and risking a prolonged entanglement in Lebanon. In the Zionist daily newspaper Yediot Ahronot, Yossi Yehoshua, under the headline, A Settlement or War of Attrition and Security Belt, cited a senior Israeli entity officer who explained that while the occupation army is expanding its ground operations into strategically significant areas, difficult questions are arising. Capturing villages, he noted, won't bring a resolution without a lasting agreement. The army will have to ramp up efforts to push Hezbollah, the Lebanese government, and key intermediaries from the U.S. to Russia towards conditions favorable to Zionist Israel. Yet operational reports indicate a challenging reality. Despite a month of ground fighting, five Israeli enemy divisions and a reserve brigade, over 50,000 troops, triple the number deployed in the 2006 Lebanon War, have made minimal advances in southern Lebanon. Despite overwhelming firepower and air support, they have been unable to capture even a single village. This failure is attributed to Hezbollah's sophisticated defensive tactics, which include a mix of fixed and mobile defense lines armed with precise anti-armor projectiles. Concealment strategies have kept the group's firing positions largely undetectable, frustrating Israeli enemy advances. Now, the difficult terrain has limited the effectiveness of Israeli entity air support, pushing the occupation army toward more war crimes, further targeting infrastructure and civilian areas. The newspaper's report further highlights that these setbacks stem from the challenge of accurately mapping Hezbollah's positions. Every attempt to advance is met with concentrated fire, intensified by small drones that the Israeli occupation forces find very hard to counter. What is happening on the ground is that Hezbollah's fighters strategically allow the Israeli occupation army to advance only to set ambushes, creating a nightmarish scenario for troops, even those in elite units like Golani and other commandos. This makes the potential human cost of any such advance staggering, possibly surpassing the total casualties sustained by the Israeli occupation army throughout its conflict since the late 1940s, including the ongoing Al-Aqsa flood operation. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. So a Zionist Israeli newspaper reported that despite deploying over 50,000 troops in southern Lebanon, the Israeli military has yet to capture even a single village. Yediot Ahronot noted that after a month of operations involving five divisions, three times the force used in 2006 war, Zionist Israel has failed to secure any foothold in the area. To discuss this issue with us via Zoom is Dr. Danielle Yagich, professor of media studies at the Lebanese American University and political commentator. A pleasure having you with us, Danielle. Now, what do you think are the key reasons behind the Israeli occupation army's inability to capture any villages in southern Lebanon, despite deploying over 50,000 troops? And how do you think Hezbollah's tactics tactical defenses of Hezbollah contributed to this failure?
Well, I think the current failure that we see once again with the Israeli regime's another attempt to invade Lebanon shows once again what has been the case historically so many times, which is that the south of Lebanon represents a graveyard for the Israeli army. If we were to approach a question about the failure, I think there are different angles, one of which, of course, is the ideological question here, because in this case, once again, the colonizer is confronted with a native people that are on their native land and is trying to advance from one stolen land, which is Palestine, to another, which is Lebanon, through relentless terror against the resistance. In particular, in the past weeks, we've seen the Israeli terror attacks all over Lebanon, sabotage, infiltration, assassination of leaders, and of course, a relentless bombardment. but it was not able to weaken the resistance. On the contrary, because the Israeli regime cannot disconnect people from their land, and the continuous Israeli aggression reiterates again resistance. And I think the failure represents this very Western colonial arrogance. At the same time, of course, from a military perspective, although the Israeli regime has a superiority, especially when it comes to the aerial bombing and bombardment, it has an advanced military infrastructure, it cannot do much on the ground. The Israeli military has a history of kidnapping people, terrorizing them, terrorizing and detaining children, burning people alive, starving them. I mean, it is unspeakable, the horrors that we've witnessed, not just in the last year in Gaza, but also throughout the past decades. But it has not been able to actually stand against an actual military force, which is Hezbollah, despite, and that's the other layer to answer this question, the geopolitical implications, because in the end, this is a U.S.-Israeli war that is being fought against the people of the region. The Israeli regime represents a proxy of the West. It would not have been able to advance even until now without this maximum support it gets in military infrastructure and, of course, the entire media imperialist framework. And despite these collective Western efforts in unleashing this genocide against Western Asia and the Israeli regime's unlimited access to those resources, it has not been able to advance, which I think, again, reiterates the power of the resistance. And, of course, add to that the many different forms and attempts to destabilize the resistance from within Lebanon via U.S. proxies in Lebanese politics and media. And again, the Israeli regime is still losing. And we could very well cite Martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who, after the liberation of Lebanon and beyond, reminded us that the Israeli regime is, in fact, weaker than a spider's web.
I would hear you there, but how do you think the operational report indicating the Israeli occupation army's minimal advances reflect on the maybe overall strategy of the Israeli entity government? And what does this suggest about the potential for probably a prolonged war against Lebanon?
Yes, so the question of time and a prolonging of the war is a very interesting one here, because on the one hand, the Israeli regime is losing on the ground. At the same time, it would benefit from prolonging the war, but the question is if it could have the capacity to continue. The other question, of course, is what would even be the Israeli strategy, because there doesn't seem to be one militarily. We remember the Netanyahu regime had outlined as its particular goals to justify once again the invasion of Lebanon by returning the settlers from northern occupied Palestine back to the settlements and to destroy the Lebanese resistance. As a result of the continuous Israeli war on Lebanon, more settlers have been displaced within occupied Palestine of 48. And of course, it is impossible to destroy the Lebanese resistance. So it is a strategic failure if there is even any strategy to advance these proclaimed goals of the Israeli regime. And so it has continued to resort to indiscriminately bombard civilians. And at the same time, of course, while the Israeli regime is spreading death and destruction in Palestine and Lebanon, we need to keep in mind that its own economy has been suffering. It is in a perpetual crisis. The Israeli regime is intensifying a war it cannot win. And a part of its strategy, at least in its communication, has recently included an implication of sectarianism against the Lebanese population, in particular the anti-incitement from the regime. And so I think what we see more recently is, again, more into the direction of genocide and trying to create chaos, at least to some extent, within Lebanon by seeking to destroy its economy, to sabotage the daily lives of Lebanese civilians. And it has to be seen to what extent this will be effective on behalf of the Zionist regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering the current military stalemate, Dr. Daniel, what would be a possible way out of the Lebanon swamp, if you will, for the Zionists in the form of a political settlement, maybe. And how does this factor into Hezbollah's calculations for future resistance if it were to include retreating till the Litani River, God forbid?
I think any political settlement will always be a compromise as long as the Israeli regime exists in its current form. We have to be very clear, the source of the ongoing suffering is the existence of the Israeli regime as a settler colonial regime. And at the same time, any cessation of hostilities is a threat to the regime, because in the end, the Israeli project necessitates perpetual warfare, because it can only exist as long as it kills and or subjugates anyone and everything that stands in its way. I think a political settlement is unlikely, because of course the Israeli regime exists outside of treaties, outside of the frameworks of international law or mechanisms of the international community, while it enjoys the maximum protection of the United States and represents its proxy. So any form of communication of the Israeli regime as violent and only knows violence. And when it comes to the ongoing questions and implications about the Litani River that we also hear oftentimes in relation to the UN resolutions that are being brought up in discussions quite often these days, they themselves, all of these proposals, including the UN resolutions, have always been in favor of the Israeli regime, because there is no way to enforce those. So from the beginning, these are attempts to weaken Lebanon, to weaken its resistance, and to put it farther within the U.S. influence, which I think is another structural problem here, because as long as the broader issues, such as the U.S. grip on Lebanese internal politics and its security situation, are not addressed structurally, any sort of negotiations or compromises would always go against the resistance and as such against the security and prosperity of the Lebanese population.
I see where you're going, and that's a major concern for most of the Lebanese people, especially those who are supportive of the resistance. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Daniel Yagich, Professor of Media Studies at the Lebanese American University and political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show, Professor. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we have Hezbollah's new vanguard.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Let's delve now into the pivotal shift within Hezbollah's leadership amid a turbulent battlefield reality. Following the assassination of Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Sheikh Naim Qassem has stepped in, reaffirming the resistance core principles and pushing back against Israeli entity claims of victory and political change. His first address highlights Hezbollah's resilience, challenging Netanyahu's narrative and signaling a new phase in the ongoing confrontation. More details in the following report.
In the wake of enduring severe blows over the past month, including the assassination of the revered martyred leader, Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah has announced the election of a new Secretary General and has successfully filled the vacancies left by the initial phase of Zionist Israeli aggression. Such a pivotal development challenges the narrative propagated by Benjamin Netanyahu, which aims to uproot Hezbollah from Lebanon and push it north to the Litani River, all while attempting to reshape a new political landscape reminiscent of the treacherous 17th of May Agreement of 1983. This strategy serves as a blueprint for a so-called new Middle East that seeks to eliminate the forces of the resistance axis. While the objective of dismantling resistance movements and altering West Asia isn't new, having been echoed during the 2006 July War, Netanyahu now leans heavily on his supposed security accomplishments to drive a strategic agenda aimed at reshaping the collective consciousness of the resistance supporters, coercing them to abandon their long-held beliefs and cultural legacies. Yet, thus far, the resistance has deftly sidestepped the internal debate that Netanyahu deems essential for his aims. In his first address as the newly appointed Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim emphasized a focus on military confrontation with the entity, striving to restore equilibrium in the rules of engagement and deterrence that were unsettled in the early days of the war. His message was clear. Hezbollah is regaining its organizational and military balance, poised to outline a decisive strategy for the future on both the battlefield and the political front. Sheikh Qasim reaffirmed the party's commitment to foundational principles of the resistance, echoing the rhetoric of the party's inception back in 1982. In his inaugural address, Hezbollah's new Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim, reaffirmed his commitment to the path set by martyr leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, emphasizing that resistance and preemptive defense remain unwavering pillars of Hezbollah's strategy. But his speech went beyond homage. It was a sharp refutation of Zionist Israeli narratives that tout achievements against Hezbollah and claim shifts in the political balance across Lebanon and the region. Netanyahu's assertions, amplified by Zionist Israeli media machinery, Western outlets, and international diplomatic cover, suggest an assumption that Hezbollah's leadership would falter and bargain under pressure. Sheikh Naim Qasim, however, turned the tables, highlighting how the Zionist army's ongoing struggle against Hezbollah drones and missiles, along with its failure to hold ground in bordering villages, reflects a growing Israeli entity vulnerability.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hussein Rahal, sociology professor at the Lebanese University and political commentator. It's always a pleasure having you with us, Professor Rahal. Now, how does the election of Sheikh Naim Qasim as Hezbollah's new secretary general reflect the organization's resilience, maybe? And in what ways does it counter the Israeli entity narrative of disrupting Hezbollah's leadership structure?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate. The election of Sheikh Naim Qasim, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, represents a political and organizational response to the Zionist narrative, which claims they have succeeded in dismantling Hezbollah across military, political, and organizational fronts. However, this election by Hezbollah's leadership asserts that the party's institutional structure is resilient enough to compensate for the loss of the towering, charismatic figure of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, whose influence extended far beyond Hezbollah's base, reaching across Lebanon and the wider region. The swift decision to appoint Sheikh Qasim as the new leader is a prompt rebuttal to Zionist claims, signaling the rapid resurgence of Hezbollah's organizational and political framework. It demonstrates the party's resolve to bridge any gaps to ensure stable operations, effective leadership, and sustained political engagement. This move reassures that Hezbollah remains politically accessible to Lebanese and foreign political entities, while simultaneously upholding internal decision-making. Thus, it stands as clear evidence of Hezbollah's swift political and organizational recovery, mirroring its resilience in the military domain.
Well, Professor, given Netanyahu's ongoing strategy to try and reshape Lebanon's political landscape, particularly with comparisons to the 17th of May agreement of 1983, what challenges does Hezbollah face in countering these political maneuvers, especially within the war going on? And how effective might its resistance narrative be in at least rallying its base and broader Lebanese support as well?
In truth, the resistance in Lebanon faces numerous challenges, and the scenario you mentioned is among the most difficult that Hezbollah and the resistance could encounter. Indeed, the Israeli enemy seeks to revive the defunct May 17 agreement, which was annulled by the Lebanese government and parliament, rendering it obsolete in Lebanon. What the Zionist enemy is now attempting is to achieve by force what it failed to secure politically in 1983. However, the situation today is very different. Back in 1982, the Israeli enemy reached Beirut within 2 to 3 weeks, and the south fell to occupation forces in just days. In contrast, now we see that frontline villages in the south, such as Ait al-Shaab, have withstood for over a month of ground assaults without falling. Just 2 days ago, the town of Khiam faced a fierce attack, and despite Israeli entity troops advancing only a few meters into its outskirts, they suffered significant losses and were forced to retreat. Another critical factor is Zionist Israel's internal front. The resistance has remained steadfast, demonstrating its renewed military strength. The Zionist Israelis are attempting to follow military success with political gains, hoping to impose a new reality that echoes the goals of the May 17 agreement. Yet, the resilience of the Lebanese people and political landscape poses a major obstacle to these ambitions. Just yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared his goals. First, to establish a demilitarized zone in South Lebanon, extending beyond the Litani River. And second, to secure unrestricted freedom to strike Lebanese territory, as seen in the recent kidnapping of a Lebanese citizen from Beitoun in northern Lebanon. These demands represent Zionist Israel's highest objectives. However, with the continued failure of the Israeli entity's ground campaign and the resistance's success in pressuring Zionist Israel's internal front through drones and missile strikes, reaching from Kiryat Shmona to Tel Aviv, both Zionist Israeli and American political ambitions are likely to diminish over time. In this context, the steadfastness of the Lebanese people and resistance has the potential to impose its own conditions, as ultimately, politics are shaped by realities on the ground. Nonetheless, the resistance still faces formidable challenges, including the issue of displacement, maintaining internal unity, and avoiding internal conflicts or civil strife. These are difficult issues that add to the pressure from Zionist Israeli political demands, which the resistance and the Lebanese people, especially those displaced, will not accept as terms of surrender. The displaced are prepared to endure, even with their homes destroyed and loved ones martyred, for the sake of victory, dignity, and pride. God willing, this resilience will shape the course of events, thanks to the steadfastness of the resistance fighters in southern Lebanon.
Well, Professor, with the Israeli occupation army struggling to hold ground against Hezbollah's defenses and advanced tactics, as you were explaining just now, how is Hezbollah leveraging this in its broader strategy, given that the resistance has indeed lost most of its first and second level commanders?
نعم تعرضت المقاومة لعدوان أدى إلى خسارتها.
Yes, the resistance has indeed endured an onslaught that led to the loss of many of its leaders and experts. A fact well known. However, I can confidently say that if a large army of a major power faced the same challenges, it would struggle to recover. Yet, the resistance rebounded remarkably quickly, regaining its capabilities within 2 to 3 weeks. This swift recovery is due to its vast reserves of trained men, numerous experts, and a cadre of educated, university-trained young fighters who can step into the roles of the martyred commanders, leaders with 30 or 35 years of experience battling the Zionist enemy. This resilience has been evident on the ground. Losing some weaponry is a natural outcome when facing a formidable military force, representing not only Zionist Israeli, but also American technology. The involvement extends beyond Zionist Israel. U.S. forces, along with British and German intelligence, provide target information, weapons, and financial support to the Israeli entity. This is, in essence, a NATO front, not merely a Zionist one. Hezbollah's losses are a consequence of this intense NATO-driven pressure, initially intended for Russia. Despite these heavy losses, Hezbollah and the resistance have largely and effectively compensated, as seen in the continuous operational efficiency of its military apparatus, a fact recognized by military experts observing the battlefield. Today, we are witnessing an extraordinary display of resilience and heroism. For example, in the scene Zionist Israel attempted to exploit, they claim to have subdued a single fighter. Yet that fighter, martyr Ibrahim Haidar, became a symbol of resistance. He held off an entire Zionist Israeli unit for hours, forcing them to resort to airstrikes to destroy the house he defended because ground forces failed to stop him. These instances showcase the resistance's operational reach, capable, in theory, of targeting Netanyahu's residence itself. Such actions demand meticulous intelligence coordination, field precision, and inter-branch coordination. The strike on the Golani Brigade's dining hall, which left over 80 Israeli entity soldiers dead or wounded, is further proof that losing key leaders has not destabilized Hezbollah. Initially, there may have been a slight disruption, but Hezbollah has quickly regained its footing. Today, it stands against the largest Zionist Israeli military force, backed by the world's foremost imperial and colonial power, the United States of America.
And it's a power that we absolutely 100% trust. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hussein Rahal, sociology professor at the Lebanese University and political commentator. It's a pleasure having you on with us. And now, ladies and gents, thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
One year of genocide in Gaza has taught us that while superior firepower may determine political outcomes in the short run, no amount of weapons can possibly break the will of a nation that has vowed to restore its dignity and win its freedom, no matter the cost. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The last year of a relentless Israeli regime war on Gaza and bloody raids and violence in the West Bank have been largely viewed in terms of their horrific humanitarian outcomes. The unequal killing of tens of thousands, the obliteration of Gaza and the destruction in the West Bank. While humanitarian urgency must indeed be a priority, other factors are also deserving of consideration, especially as we mark the one-year anniversary on the ongoing war. Even though the mass killing is yet to end, there are several conclusions that can already be drawn about the long-term consequences of the war. 1. Palestinians, despite the military occupation and the siege, remain political actors with powerful agency. This agency does not stem from any superficial achievements of their autocratic leadership or still symbolic recognition of the state of Palestine, but the collective resilience and the power of ordinary Palestinians in Gaza and throughout the occupied Palestine. The war in Gaza would have looked different if Palestinian society broke down in the face of the war machine, fragmented into fighting factions, or grew desperate in the face of impossible pressures, war, unprecedented destruction, acute famine, etc. This fact alone reassures us that the Palestinian people's destiny will not be that of erasure or even marginalization, but of continuity and even future prosperity. Two, that Arab societies, however, consumed with their own struggles, social and political challenges, remain united in perceiving the Palestinian cause as a top Arab priority. This has allowed many Arab governments to reiterate their position regarding the centrality of the Palestinian cause. Though current circumstances may, for now, prevent some Arab societies from being direct participants in turning their devotion to Palestine into tangible and practical support, the future shall prove that the renewed centrality of Palestine in Arab political and popular discourses will have its own weight and value. The same logic applies to the Muslim Ummah, which has never been so united around the cause in decades as it is now united around Palestine. This can be felt in all Muslim countries and among Muslim communities around the world, especially in the West. The future shall reveal more regarding the meaning of the return of Palestine to the embrace of Muslims. However, one can already conclude that the resilience of the Palestinian people has once more refocused the attention on Palestine as the leading cause of all Arabs and Muslims. 3. Though international law remains as ineffective as ever, the bloody war in Palestine is creating rifts between the global South and the global North. The latter, with a few exceptions, remains adamant in repeating old mantras about the Zionist regime's right to defend itself, while disregarding all Palestinian rights. However, many countries in Africa, the West Asia region, South America, and elsewhere are becoming louder and bolder in their demands for justice for Palestinians and for the equal application of international law. The Global South political revolt has already resulted in slow but serious actions taken by the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and, as of late, the United Nations General Assembly as well. The UN General Assembly passed a resolution on September 17th that assigned an actual deadline for when the Israeli occupation of Palestine must end, Resolution AES-10-L31, REV-1, and its no later than 12-month deadline essentially declared null and void all actions that the Zionist regime has illegally carried out in the occupied territories, including all settlements, annexation of Palestinian land, and all the rest. 4. A whole generation of people around the world has been affected by the horror show in Gaza. The gory images, the desperate pleas of children who lost their parents, the unbelievable destruction and the failure of the international system to stop any of this will be etched in the collective memory of the world for many years to come. This means that the boundaries of global solidarity with Palestine will finally break the confines of the West Asia into new and growing geographic and cultural spaces, and that, at least in the West, Palestine will no longer remain a political discussion or an academic subject. The new global consciousness that has developed around the Palestinian struggle may have already achieved the required critical mass, which will, with time, result in the much-coveted paradigm shift, justice for the Palestinian people. And last, 1 year of genocide has taught us that, while superior firepower may determine political outcomes in the short run, no amount of weapons can possibly break the will of a nation that has vowed to restore its dignity and its win, its freedom, no matter the cost.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer your queries and questions and we discuss very important topics on Islamic upbringing of your children. Our answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much.
So, dear listeners, Brother Liaqat is really interested in conducting research in the fields of Islamic history, psychology, and philosophy. And currently, he's pursuing a master's degree in Islamic psychology at Jamiat al-Mustafa Institute of Islamic and Social Sciences. Well, Brother Liaqat, again, a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much, sister.
So in the previous episode, you were explaining the love, the way parents should show to their children. And while you explained the examples from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, there was one concept that I wanted to add. There's this man who was a slave, and his name is John, in the tragedy of Karbala. He has been with the Ahlul Bayt family from a long time. Like, it was a slave that was brought by Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he gave him to as a gift to Ammar, and then constantly he had been passing on from one to another. Like, in the end, he was with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. While he was freed many times, but he begged to be in the family of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And then in the tragedy of Karbala, he sacrifices his life for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, while Imam tells him, like, you have already done a lot of service to us and you're not authorized to fight with us again. But he says that, is it just because my color is black, because he was an African slave? Is it just because I'm a slave? And then Imam hugs him and gives him the permission to fight. And then finally, when he gets martyred in the Battle of Karbala, I want to say, Imam, the way his farewell with the body of John was exactly the way his farewell was with the body of Ali Akbar alayhi salam. Like, a poet says it beautifully, wo wafa ki intaha thi ye ata ki intaha hai, which means what John did was the intensity of loyalty, and what Imam did was the intensity of what Imam could provide him with, what Imam could give him. So he exactly treated John. He kissed his forehead, he kissed him, and he kissed also Ali Akbar alayhi salam. So Imams are not only showing this love and affection, hugging and kissing only to their children, to their sons, but also the same kind of affection to an African slave who actually got martyred in the Battle of Karbala. Well, I wanted to add this because I wanted to say, like, Imams have been very, very generous in when it comes to giving, and when it comes to giving love as well. So they have been very generous as well.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Thank you so much for the introduction. Of course, I wanted to add a bit upon what you have said. Indeed, the Ahlul Bayt, this holy family who are the role models to us and our children, to our teenagers especially, they show a lot of generosity, a lot of love and affection, not only to their children, but also to others' children.
Right.
And this actually gives us a big lesson for the elders, example. To not just show love and affection just to our children, but also to the teenagers or children in our community. I still remember, like, there were a few elders who were very stern, who were very angry towards those children or teens who used to make a bit of noise in masajid.
Right.
I still used to remember. And they used to be very angry at them, saying kind of being impolite,
rude.
Yeah,
right.
Being rude, impolite, using hard words, yeah, harsh words and stuff. So this is not what we learn from the Ahlul Bayt, isn't it? Example, if we see on the night of Ashura, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam would bring the opportunity for those who are with him, his ashab, I would say. His companions, his noble companions, saying, this is the time of night, and in this part of night you can leave me and go away. What the enemy wants is me and not you all. So if the enemy gets me, it's enough for them. So you are just over here just to support me. You can leave me because I have made you free, basically. You're not...
Right. You're not carrying any more allegiance.
Exactly.
I'll just want you to explain that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned. We'll be back in a while.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're with Brother Liaquat. Brother Liaquat, you were saying that we learn a lot from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and we were saying the night of Ashura when Imam was telling his companions that I have taken back my allegiance from you and you're free, you can leave. The enemy wants me and you can just leave.
So after that, we see the companions one by one, starting from Hazrat Abbas, alayhi salam, his noble brother, saying, how can we leave you? You see, what is there left in our life in this world if we leave you? And one by one, there are others like Zuhair, example, and there's a Muslim and the other companions who speak one by one. And we see a young teen as well speaking to his imam. So when the imam looks at his companions and everyone are saying one after the other, like, we are not going to leave you. We are going to give away our life. We are going to sacrifice our lives for your sake and for your protection. And then the imam says, okay, you all are going to be martyred tomorrow. So this is what the imam says. Then we see a teen standing up, whose name was Qasim ibn Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam.
Right.
Then he says, oh, my uncle, will I get martyred as well tomorrow on the day of Ashura? Then the imam turns back and asks him one question. How is death near you? Where we see this young teen who was just 13 years old, he's saying, ahla min al-asal, saying death is more sweeter to me than honey. When it comes to the protection of imam, of course, like another teenagers, whom we see, of course, he is brought up in the family of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam.
And a teenager wants to live. A teenager
exactly.
wants to explore.
Exactly. Everything what we have in our day-to-day lives, we see them happening even in the lives of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. Just to keep a small thing in brackets, people would ask, why should we pray for the imam of our time? he is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like he is a selected one, and he's always under the protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The answer to it is no. Imam is right now in a human being form. He eats, he drinks, he goes to sleep, he needs rest, he gets tired, and he also gets sick. Yeah, of course, like we see Imam Sajjad al-Islam getting sick on the day, on the last days of like when it was in near Muharram, it was near Ashura, on the 8th of Muharram, they say Imam got sick and he was unable to stand, you see. So likewise, the Imam of the time, the 12th Imam, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keep him safe and give him good health every time, inshallah, even he gets sick. So we have to pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, oh Allah, make my Imam safe from the calamities, from all the illnesses and stuff. So this is like basically inside the bracket, I would say. So just like a teen, basically, he also has a lot of desires to live, to explore the world. And just like any other teen, like if the listener is a teenager, he should know that it's not something that, he's the Imam's son, so his teenagehood is different than mine. Right. No, it's not like that. Even the teenagers, when the Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim were teens, when they were in their 11, 12 years, or even like 18 until 18, 20, they have the same desires just like us. They go through the same physical process just like all
because
of us.
Because they were humans.
Exactly.
We'll discuss more with you, brother, after a short break. Dear listener, stay tuned.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Allah will write a reward for he who kisses his child, and Allah will bring happiness on Judgment Day to he who makes his child happy.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is with us. And Brother Liaquat, who was saying that teenagehood has not been different for Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. They have gone through the same phase as us because they were brought to earth in the form of human beings.
Indeed. So we also see with the life of Hazrat Qasim ibn Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, saying death is more sweeter to me than honey, isn't it? So the question rises, he wants to die just like that? No, he wants to die for the sake of Imam. So a teenager can sacrifice his life for the sake of his Imam. If a teenager can sacrifice his life for the sake of Imam, then it is really possible that he can also sacrifice his desires. Because death is the highest form of desire to a person, isn't it? Like, basically, if he's alive, he can do everything. But if he dies, example, he can't do anything. His desires are gone, his hopes are gone, his aims are gone, like if he's dead, isn't it?
Right.
If he's alive, he can do everything else, yeah? So death is the highest form which a person can... life is the highest form which a person can ever wish for. So keeping death in place of life gives a meaning that he's sacrificing all his desires, aims, hopes, everything is gone, yeah? So for the sake of Imam, if a person can give his life away, meaning death is something he wishes for the sake of Imam, then I would say definitely a person can sacrifice his desires as well for the sake of Imam. Like teenagers would come to us and ask, oh, you know what? Today I'm addicted to this thing, example, this particular sin, example. The reply to it is how are we seeing the lifestyle of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam? How are we seeing the tarbiyah or their upbringing towards the teenagers, you see? And also it's not just Hazrat Qasim alayhi salatu wasalam on the day of Ashura who got martyred, who was a teen. There were other teenagers too on the day of Ashura who got martyred. And also one more thing, it's not always the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam who were the nurturers or those who were the teachers, like to their children. Example, Junada, if we see his father is not from the family of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. He was just a normal person.
Right.
But we see that he, Junada, has sacrificed himself. And we have a famous quote of his Rajas, what he has what he told in front of when he was confronting the enemy. He said, Amiri Hussein wa ni'amal Amir, which is very famous
right.
even till today. Yeah. Amiri Hussein, my leader is Hussein alayhi salam wa ni'amal Amir. And how beautiful is this leader for me, isn't it?
Right.
So we have to see.
This was all the tarbiyah.
Exactly. This is a tarbiyah. This is upbringing of the father who taught his child how to be towards the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Right.
Indeed.
Thank you so much, brother, for being with us and helping us with those informative insights. Thank you, dear listeners, who are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanon's Hezbollah targets two important Israeli military bases with missiles in its latest retaliatory operations against the regime. Yemenis take to the streets in the northern city of Sa'ada denouncing Israeli crimes against Palestinian and Lebanese people. And also in our headlines, tensions deepen between Israel and France over the detention of two French consulate members in Al-Quds. Our top story for this half hour, Israel's air and artillery strikes cause more death and destruction in Lebanon as the regime presses ahead with its aggression against the country. At least three civilians were killed and seven others injured after an Israeli drone strike targeted a vehicle in the southern city of Sidon. The UN said there were at least five Malaysian peacekeepers among those injured. The raid in which the UN peacekeepers were wounded struck near an army checkpoint, leaving three Lebanese soldiers injured as well. In a separate airstrike on a building in the southern city of Zebdin, three family members lost their lives, while another strike in western Beqa left three dead and four injured. Altogether, 13 civilians were killed in Israel's Thursday attacks, bringing the death toll from the regime's strikes since last October to over 3,100. More than 13,800 others have been injured. Sirens have sounded following Hezbollah's missile attack on a naval base near the Israeli city of Haifa. The Lebanese resistance movement says its fighters have hit the Stella Maris naval base northwest of Haifa with a missile barrage. This is the second attack on the base in less than 24 hours. Before that, Hezbollah targeted the Ramat David base, an airport in southeast of Haifa as well. Resistance fighters also ambushed an Israeli infantry force near the town of Yarun, killing and wounding a number of its personnel. Hezbollah says its anti-Israel attacks are in response to the massacre of people in Lebanon and Gaza. More Palestinian civilians are falling victim to the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza as the Tel Aviv regime continues with its relentless attacks across the block.